This is the Public Radio Hour, a weekly mix of podcasts, special programs, and homemade radio features. Tonight, we're headed to the Morgan County Decatur Farmers Market for stories of rare beef, cantaloupes, and true love.
I decided that I wanted to get back to the farm, so I got on farmersonly.com, and I met my husband.
We'll hear about scenes from Cuba, floating sculptures, and a room of blue as we preview Art After Hours, coming up this Friday night at Low Mill.
And there's all these different artists from around the world that have sent in pieces about the connections and the distances and the way they feel about the color blue.
We'll also get a lesson in friction stir welding as we say goodbye to a locally built component for the Space Launch System, and we'll hear how a historic dam failure gave rise to the American Red Cross. This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville. Stay tuned, a news update is next. This is 89.3 Huntsville, and you're listening to the Public Radio Hour, a weekly mix of unique programs and homemade radio features. A lot will happen in the next 53 minutes. We'll hear about the Huntsville-built LVSA that will connect sections of the Space Launch System and take a radio preview tour of this Friday's Art After Hours at Low Mill. We'll also have 51%, Engines of Our Ingenuity, and an Alabama Legacy moment. But first, Kathy Main takes us down to the train tracks, to the Morgan County Decatur Farmers Market, for another installment of our series, The Market is Open. Let's meet some Tennessee Valley farmers.
My name is Ann Ingram, and my husband Jack and I operate Olive Branch Wagyu Farm in Cullman, Hartsel, and Addison, Alabama.
Tell me a little bit about this special beef.
Wagyu beef originates in Japan. People might know it as Kobe beef, but Kobe beef has been trademarked because it is only raised, Wagyu cattle only raised in Kobe, Japan. We have the first full blood born in the state of Alabama, and we've been selling our beef in markets for 6 years now.
Were you a farmer and decided to do go into the cattle business, or is just this just something that you all decided to do?
No, we had neither one raised cows before. And we were going to raise calves and sell them at the stockyard, but we received a Christmas gift of exotic meats in 1 year, and it had Wagyu fillets, and it was so delicious we decided to go this route. After researching the breed, and they're very hardy, they're easy to raise, and they're calm, and so that's why we decided to go that route.
My name is James Hansford, and I have Hansford Farms in Limestone County on East Limestone Road.
What is it that you sell?
I have had corn, tomatoes, squash, okra, green beans, and I'll have sweet potatoes and some more tomatoes later on, and some more peas.
How long have you been farming?
For about 25 years.
Why did you start farming?
Well, we're thinking about retiring, and I didn't want to just lay around, so I found me something to do. And I like what I do.
Had you farmed before that? Is this like in your family?
Well, it was in my family. I didn't like it when it was a family thing. I just didn't like it. It's different now.
Hey, my name is Elizabeth Thompson, and I am the market manager at the Morgan County Decatur Farmers Market. We have honey, all kinds of produce, jams and jellies, pasture-fed meats, and baked goods.
Elizabeth, you have quite a story on how you got here. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, I grew up in Decatur, and my dad had a dairy farm in Hartsel. And then when I started my professional career teaching, I decided that I wanted to get back to the farm. So I got on farmersonly.com, and I met my husband. And we have been married now 3 years, and we are more farm enthusiasts now and have raised beds. But I sold Humble Heart goat cheese, worked for Humble Heart Farms for a couple years, and ended up, when this position came open, I applied, and that's how I'm here at the farmer's market now.
My name is Randy Bowerman, RB Farms in Moulton, Alabama. The corn is gone for me this year. Had a few cantaloupes, are very good this year. About two more weeks on watermelons.
So was this a family farm that you inherited?
Yes, yes. My mother and daddy, I'm from Blount County in Bluntsville, Alabama. And I moved to Moulton in 77. And there's a few years that I did not farm or didn't have a garden. But now then, I'm right back just like my mother and daddy did.
What's the favorite part of your day?
Being alive.
If you had some advice to give to someone who wanted to go into farming, what would it be?
It's very rewarding. I enjoy watching things grow, enjoy people, and enjoying the fruits of your labor.
My name is Jeanette Witt. I'm from Town Creek, Alabama, and we do a few vegetables and muscadines right now. I'm into picking muscadines and pear preserves. I make pear preserves. I pick my own pears.
How did you decide to go into this business?
I think I like to dig in the dirt. It gives you satisfaction to get out there and dig and make it look pretty. And I also do a lot of flowers. I do elephant ears and iris and different kind of homegrown flowers.
What is the best part of your day?
Getting up and drinking coffee about 4:30 and then going outside before it gets hot to work in the garden. Now it's a lot of cleaning up to do, and you have to do it early because you get skin cancers if you stay out there in the middle of the day. He told me to quit going out there in the middle of the day.
If you had some advice to give to someone that wanted to go into farming, what would it be?
It's hard work, but you have to want to do it. You have to enjoy it. If you enjoy it, it ain't very hard, but it's still hard when you get older. I'm 72. Yes, I'm 72.
Storyteller Catherine Tucker Windham once said, "Age ain't nothing but numbers," and there's some proof right there. You can find this segment and a podcast of tonight's show at WLRH.org and on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Next, one last play for this month's featured programs, 51% and Engines of Our Ingenuity. We'll also have an Alabama Legacy moment coming up. Next month, tune in for a compelling documentary series on education in America produced by American Public Media. This is the Public Radio Hour on listener-supported 89.3 Huntsville. Thanks for tuning in.
On this week's 51%, we bring you more of an interview with a woman who aims to balance the masculine-feminine scales and meet a slam poet whose art form is mixing with more traditional poetry.
A lot of my poetry is very raw. A lot of it is based off of real life experience and like real pain or loss or love that I've had.
I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. We start by bringing you part two of an interview focused on tapping into the power of femininity in leadership. Social entrepreneur Nina Simons, co-founder of Bioneers in 1990 in Santa Fe, New Mexico, has spent more than 20 years investigating the power of femininity to solve some of humanity's greatest challenges, both environmental and social, convening in an annual conference. In part one of the interview, Simons spoke with KALW's Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller about how leading from the feminine began. This second part of the interview delves into the conference itself and more. Schiller asked Simons what it will take for that shift to happen when we're no longer fighting the system, but creating a system where both the masculine and feminine are valued.
Well, I think we'll get there. I mean, I'm deeply optimistic by nature. And I think there's evidence of it in, you know, when I look at couples raising children in their 20s and 30s right now, there's an awful lot more sharing of housework and of parenting. And, you know, I look at my grandkids and I see how beautifully their parents just pass the ball. And there's no question about what's mom's role and what's dad's role. They're just co-parenting. So I think there's a lot of evidence of change, and I think in a way it's a generational shift that we're experiencing. And this is related to how we heal from systems of privilege and bias. And I've been a student for the last 10 years or so about white privilege and racial bias. And what I've learned is that there are a lot of things that translate from gender justice to racial justice. So for instance, what I've learned from being a woman of privilege, from being a white woman in this country, is that privilege creates blinders and it normalizes its own experience. And so it took me a long time to understand that I had privilege and to not feel guilty or ashamed or weird about it, but to actually embrace it so that I could say, I'm going to use this privilege to help make it different. And I think the same is true for men. I think that, you know, women know when we talk in circles or conferences of women about the experience of being in an all-male boardroom and raising an idea and having it fall on deaf ears, and then the guy next to you says the same thing in a different language and everybody jumps on it. Every woman around is nodding her head because we all know that. We've all experienced it. Men, however, don't see that. They don't see it when it happens. And it's not anyone's fault as an individual. It's a challenge of the system, is how do we awaken to the blinders that privilege creates for us?
Tell me about some of the work that you've been doing with women's leadership training.
Well, for the last 12 years, we have been developing a program that we called Cultivating Women's Leadership. And it's a 6-day immersion experience that we invite women to apply for and then select each cohort of 20 women very carefully. And we've been selecting women for a number of criteria. One criteria, for example, was we really want to know how passionate they are about making change in the world, because those are the women we most want to work with. And another is there evidence of this woman being able to influence change in her community or constituency? And the third criteria, which is perhaps the most interesting, is that we select each cohort to optimize for diversity in every way. And what that means is that each cohort typically has women ranging in age from their 20s to their 70s or 80s, and across all kinds of ethnic diversity, and across sexual preference and discipline. And so you get this, you know, a group of women who in normal life in our country would never get to encounter each other in a deep way, and give them 6 days to do a lot of deep work, both on an individual level and with each other. And by the end of the 6 days, what's been remarkable is that very often those women have bonded really deeply with each other. And they've formed connections that are lasting years later, which is part of our intention. So that's been a journey. We always knew that it was important to us to have a lot of ethnic and racial diversity in the room. And it was hard to do, partly because at that time, I was doing most of the facilitating with the woman who I really co-founded the program with, who was another white woman. And I read a book by Linda Tarr Whalen called Women Lead the Way. And what I learned from that book was that there is social science that shows that for any minority to fully show up in a group, they need to be at least 30% of the room. And I thought, well, that's so interesting because, I mean, part of what they said was until they're at 30%, they just don't feel flanked enough to take the risks to really be outspoken and really be themselves. And then I reflected on that in relation to the percentage of women in our House and Senate, which is not even remotely close, right? And we made a decision as soon as I read that book. We said, okay, from this point forward, we are always going to have a minimum of 30% women of color in our groups. And we brought in facilitators who were women of color so that there was always a third facilitator 33% of us was a woman of color. And as soon as we did that, we started getting 35 to 50% women of color in our trainings. And that's been an incredible teaching for me and really interesting in terms of all the things we're talking about, from the boardroom to classrooms to, in this case, learning environments and gathering groups together.
Well, I'd love to talk more about how you ultimately embraced your role as a leader. So, you know, the Utney Reader says, you know, amazing things about you, puts you on their cover. You say no. And then you go and you try and understand why you might have felt that way. And so how have you come to terms with yourself?
Well, I had this big turning point moment when I turned 40. So it was 20 years ago, and I made myself several promises at that point. And one of them was about understanding and unpacking this leadership conundrum that I'd gotten into. And another was that I decided that I needed to learn to live more from my feminine side. And all my friends said, "Are you kidding? You're so feminine." And I said, "Well, it may look that way to you, but on the inside, I can tell you the way I've navigated my adult life has been through what I experience as my more masculine qualities. You know, I've relied heavily on my intellect and my analysis and my capacity for strategic thinking and my strong body and ability to power through and be persevering at all costs. And what I knew was that there were a lot of parts of me that felt under-exercised, under-seen, under-acknowledged. And so I began exploring that. And what I found was that it was like every cell in my body said yes when I started doing that. There was something deep inside me that was affirmed and that said, "Oh yeah, your dreams. Oh yeah, listening to your intuition. Oh, what about this sensual thing? Like, what about listening to your body's wisdom?" And what I began to realize was that from my gender lens perspective, part of the inheritance of a biased culture has been that we value the intellect over all of our other ways of knowing. And so I really went through a conscious process of trying to turn up the volume on all of my other ways of knowing and practice valuing them. And I think part of how I did that really was through gathering and facilitating groups of women. The first time I gathered women was actually in 2002, and I convened 35 very diverse women leaders for a gathering called Unreasonable Women for the Earth.
And I love the title.
It was inspired by an amazing activist named Diane Wilson, who had spoken at Bioneers, and at the end of her talk, she said, "I'm going to adapt a George Bernard Shaw quote that says, you know," and he wrote it about men, but I'm going to say it about women. And she said, "A reasonable woman accepts the world as it is, and an unreasonable woman works to change the world as he knows it needs to be." So, as she knows it needs to be. So she said, looking out at the audience, "I encourage you all to be unreasonable because the earth really needs us now." And that phrase just stuck in my head. So I wound up convening 35 amazing women, and I had no idea what I was doing. I was making it all up as I went along. And we spent 4 or 5 days together and in a very beautiful place. And what actually emerged from that gathering was Code Pink, Women for Peace, which is kind of a good outgrowth of something called Unreasonable Women. I learned that it's very important what title you organize under.
Would you say leading from the feminine and leading from the heart are interchangeable expressions, or would you define them slightly differently?
Oh, gosh. Well, you know, I think we're in a time where language can be a trap. And so leading from the heart is much more accessible to most people. However, for me, it's not the same, because leading from the feminine is bigger than leading from the heart. It actually includes leading from your connection to the divine or spirit, as well as intuition, as well as your body's awareness. I think they're all intelligences that have been chronically undervalued. So for me, leading from the feminine includes all those three realms, not just the heart.
It's so refreshing because I just feel like we're living in this world that is being led by fear.
Yeah.
And that all of the decisions that are being made, you know, at the government level and probably at the corporate level and maybe sometimes at the family level are based on fear.
Yes.
And yes. It's messing with us. Mm-hmm. And the way you're talking about it, it's, you know, it feels like it's completely the inverse.
Well, it's really interesting you say that. I agree. And I think that we are living through a time when pretty well anyone alive and paying attention is dealing with some post-traumatic stress. I mean, I think life is that stressful right now. And I think young people growing up with an awareness of climate change, it's a big stressor. And so part of what I'm interested in is really how do we develop the capacity for resilience in ourselves? And some of that means going against the tide for sure, you know, because with things speeding up as much as they are and as much media and as much information coming at us and all that stuff, it's becoming increasingly important to slow down and to actually go inside. You know, there's a very interesting correlation to all this stuff about the feminine, too, which I love and I remind myself often, which is that Carl Jung suggested that the feminine is our interiority and the masculine is our exterior. And when you think about all that fear-based, panic-driven motion, it's very externally focused. And it's pursuing some imagined safety or security that probably isn't very real. And I feel like the only real security lies inwardly and in our relationships. I think it's really through, you know, a web of connection to the people we love and who love us, and also to the places we love and the creatures we love and the whatever it is we love, you know, that's, to me, that's security. Because we all know, you know, corporations are laying people off right and left. And this whole notion that you're going to just have a straight up career and then retire with a gold watch, it ain't happening anymore, you know? So I think we need to shift our understanding of what security really means. And also, you know, for me, what's exciting about the path that keeps revealing itself to me is inviting people into a life of meaning. Because there's an awful lot of distraction out there. And what I found, you know, it's part of the work we do in these women's leadership retreats. We do something we call a purpose marathon. And it's a very long afternoon where that has a lot of repeated questioning in it. And it's sort of like peeling an onion skin because you go deeper and deeper inside yourself to notice what you really love dearly. And what all your life has been a really resonant thing and what breaks your heart open. You know, I know for me, when I read stories about whales dying of stomach cancer because of all the plastic inside them, it breaks my heart. You know, and when I learn about the rate of extinction and that we may not have large mammals in another 20, 30 years on this planet, it really hurts me. And I don't know why that is, and I don't really care why that is. I care that it motivates me and that it's a way into my deepest passion. And so for me, I feel like the work of this time is for each of us to find what we're most exactly called to do and then invest ourselves there. You know, I once had a guide suggest to me that I was very impatient about finding my path. And I thought, why don't I know what it is? And why isn't it clear? And how do I get there faster? And what she said was, she suggested that I invest in my longing. She said, your longing lives in a chamber behind your heart. And if you invest your attention there, it will attract to you what you most want to have happen. And, you know, I didn't know if I believed in it or not, but I tried it. And I actually think it works.
What's the best advice that you've ever been given about how to slow down?
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One piece of advice was also about identifying your purpose, but it's related to how to slow down and how to listen inwardly. And so I had a great teacher say to me, pay exquisite attention inwardly to what makes your flame grow brighter. And she said, you have to be very still and pay a lot of attention, because sometimes that flame just perks up just in an instant and it's like, poof. And if you're not paying attention, you'll miss it. So that was great guidance. And the other thing that actually is very alive in me these days, I'm teaching a workshop with a woman who is a wonderful mindfulness teacher. And she lived on a Zen monastery for 7 years. And in many ways, I think what she has done is to feminize meditation and Zen. And what she teaches is that meditation is the subtlest form of self-love. So, you know, so it's this quality, and I can't profess to say that I'm a great meditator. I'm not. But there's a quality of really deep listening inwardly to all the parts of yourself that feels to me like a great way to slow down. And the other way that I practice all the time is being in nature, is go to nature, you know, and I always find that when I'm depressed or stressed or freaked out or confused, being in nature is my solace.
That was Nina Simons, co-founder of Bioneers, speaking with Inflection Point host Lauren Schiller, produced at KALW in San Francisco. Hear Schiller's other conversations at inflectionpointradio.org and on her Inflection Point podcast. And you can hear the first part of the interview in 51% show number 1465.
This is an Alabama legacy moment.
Popularly known as the Coondog Cemetery, the Key Underwood Coondog Memorial Graveyard in Colbert County was established in 1937. The cemetery is the final resting place for more than 150 coonhounds. Despite its remote location, nearly 7,000 people visit each year. In order for a dog to be buried at the site, the Coon Hunters Association must verify that the dog is an authentic coon dog. Although a pedigree or a specific breed is not required for qualification, the dog must have been a hunting dog and must have hunted raccoons exclusively. The Tennessee Valley Coon Hunters Association hosts a celebration each Labor Day to mark the founding of the cemetery. Entertainment includes music, a liar's contest, and buck dancing. The cemetery's interments feature headstones made of wood, granite, and natural stone. Many of the grave markers are hand-chiseled by the owners. Visitors can enjoy the decorative elements of the graves, as well as the dog's colorful names and epitaphs.
Sponsored by the Alabama Bicentennial Commission, the ABA, and this station.
This is the Engines of Our Ingenuity, made possible in part by NG, sustainable energy and tools for efficiency and carbon reduction.
Today, a dam breaks. The University of Houston's College of Engineering presents this series about the machines that make our civilization run and the people whose ingenuity created them. It's 1889. The South Fork Creek Dam and its reservoir up in the western Pennsylvania hills belong to a posh country club based in Pittsburgh. Andrew Carnegie is a member. From there, it's 14 miles down the South Fork to Stony Creek. Hills rise sharply on either side. You wind under a 76-foot railroad viaduct, past half a dozen towns, and finally arrive at Johnstown, population 30,000. In 1856, a promoter named William Kelly returned to his native Johnstown with claims to have invented a new steel smelting process. In fact, he'd created only one part of the Bessemer process. Speculators invested in Kelly, but when they established the Cambria Steel Company, they used Bessemer's equipment and Andrew Carnegie's money. Johnstown mushroomed into a major steel town. The South Fork Creek Dam, finished in 1852, was 930 feet wide by 60 feet high. It held a lot of water, and it had a troubled history. It underwent restoration and repairs, but never quite enough. Its custodians, the so-called Bosses Club, were unconcerned. It was a pure earth dam with no masonry reinforcement. The club had stocked the lake with fish, and to keep them from escaping, they'd put a screen of iron bars across the overflow spillway. Trash accumulated and plugged up the screen. Late May rains were heavy in 1889. On May 31st, indications were ominous. Water rising, bridges washed out. Finally, around noon, a message from a telegraph operator at the dam reached Johnstown. South Fork Dam is liable to break. Notify the people of Johnstown to prepare for the worst. The Johnstown freight agent shrugged it off. At 1:52, a telegram announced that water was overflowing the dam. At 2:45, a third telegram came. It said the dam was about to go. Johnstown citizens were putting all their energies into moving rugs off floors as the creek rose. They had no conception of what would happen when a body of water 1 mile by 3 and 60 feet deep got loose. At first, water flowing over the dam cut a notch, which quickly deepened. Around 3:15, water simply pushed the two sides apart, and the whole reservoir spilled out. Water started down the valley at 30 miles an hour, submerged that 76-foot viaduct, and drove anything loose before it. By the time it reached the towns above Johnstown, a black dust cloud obscured a mountain of racing water. Hundreds of eyewitnesses gave an inkling of the horror. Houses exploding, people crushed by trees or railway cars, the terrible sound, acts of heroism glimpsed out of the corner of an eye. The dead numbered somewhere over 2,200. As a horrified nation closed in on the carnage, one glimpse of heroism was Clara Barton. Her new American Red Cross met its first major challenge. She moved in to build food kitchens, hospitals, and housing. The light at the end of this awful tunnel was a major new force for easing human suffering. I'm John Leinhardt at the University of Houston, where we're interested in the way inventive minds work.
A transcript of this Engines of Our Ingenuity episode number 1391 is online at uh.edu/engines. Additional episodes are available by podcast.
This is the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville. Coming up, a preview of Art After Hours and a visit with the Launch Vehicle Stage Adapter. But first, the final segment of 51%.
Slam poets and sonnet lovers usually don't hang out together, but in Winona, Minnesota, they do. KFAI's Sylvia Thomas reports on an unusual poetry pairing that's redefining local definitions of the art form.
3 years ago, Nicole Ramsey ducked out of her dorm room and crashed a local poetry reading. She was new to town, a college freshman at St. Mary's University in Winona. And she was a rookie poet. As she settled into her seat, Ramsey heard poems like this.
One wave follows another beneath the heel of the wind. The spray blows landward, but lacking salt or iodine, it smells oddly Protestant.
Then it was her turn.
I read a poem, and it was like a trashy poem about weird things that I did at a party and like peeing on a building. And afterwards, this one woman who must have been 70 at the youngest came up to me and was like, I loved that poem. It reminded me of when I was young. And that moment kept me coming back.
So in between classes and studying, Ramsey found time to attend readings sponsored by the Winona Poet Laureate Program, a local creative writing initiative.
You don't think of that when you see anyone who's, you know, 50, 60 years older than you. You don't think, oh, wow, they were once 21, too, peeing on school buildings.
Ramsey became a regular at the readings, soaking in the aroma of espresso at the Blue Heron Coffee House as she listened to other people's work. And she read her own poems, too.
The thing about Nicole is that she's not afraid.
This is Ken McCullough. He's a regular at the readings.
Whenever Nicole reads in an open mic situation, everybody who hears her, even, you know, the veteran poets, they say, wow, she is really good.
and I stopped shaving my legs when they weren't smooth like the other girls with porcelain bulimia and straight B report cards. And I would go to school and hear the whisperings of the off-white Dyke Oreo, and he once told me no one would ever love a girl like me.
Most of her poems have to do with social justice in one way or another, and I know that every time I hear her, I start thinking myself about what I could be doing that works in that same mode. I figure it's going to be distinctly different from what she does, but people are going to say, I've never heard him work in that style before.
Slam poetry, how I interpret it, is there's a heavy emphasis on the spoken element of it rather than like the written word. 300 girls disappeared and we forgot. Which leads to the question, when do Black Lives Matter? Where I say 300 girls disappeared and we forgot. That's a line that I was like, I have to stop in this one and think of it. Because a lot of people don't even like remember or realize that Boko Haram is still alive and well and terrorizing humans.
That and other troubling themes are at the heart of Ramsey's work.
A lot of my poetry is very raw. A lot of it is based off of real life experience and like real pain or loss or love that I've had.
So after 3 years of sharing her work at local readings, Ramsey, even though she's barely old enough to drink, recently applied to be the city's poet laureate.
Basically, even though they made the requirements so much less than what it has been in years past, I still didn't meet them. I definitely applied for a job I wasn't qualified for.
The judges saw it that way too. They chose someone else, Ken McCullough, the guy you heard earlier in this story, for the position. But they liked Ramsey's work so much, they offered her a gig as associate poet laureate. And since she'd taken a break from school to catch up on bills, she was making lattes when she heard the news.
I was actually at work, and one of the women on the Fine Arts Commission came in, and she, like, pulled me aside, and I'm in my apron and everything, and she's like, just to let you know, it's going to be official. It's not official yet. Like, don't tell anyone, but it's going to happen. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm going to tell everyone.
In Winona, poet laureates read and write poetry for citywide occasions, like bridge christenings, historic meetings, and such. On the surface, McCullough and Ramsey appear to be an unusual pair. He's a gray-bearded 73-year-old. She's a sassy 21. But the poets say that they look forward to working together as poet laureate and associate poet laureate. For KFAI, I'm Sylvia Thomas.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1466.
We hope you enjoyed 51% and Engines of Our Ingenuity. During the month of September, the Public Radio Hour presents a new documentary series from American Public Media, exploring education in America. We hope you enjoy it. This Friday night at Low Mill Arts and Entertainment, you can take a unique artistic adventure of photography, painting, and sculpture. Low Mill's Amy Mayfield dropped by to talk with Beth Norwood about art after hours. Let's take a radio preview.
On Second Floor North, we have Cuba Troika Soul, and it features the work of three photographers, including Karen Graffio, Chip Cooper,
yes,
and Julio Laramide.
Wow.
And they've traveled to Cuba several times together over the year. Julio's from there. He's done lots of books about photography that feature his wonderful work. And so North Floor is filled with the sights and colors of Cuba as captured by these three photographers.
Now, my husband once said
to me that if you like Florida as a vacation place, that you would love Cuba even more because it's even more fantastic.
Well, and it's only 90 miles from Florida, which I don't think a lot of people realize. But there's actually a piece in the show that talks about 90 miles to Cuba.
Isn't that amazing? What else is fantastic is Miss Karen Graffio herself, because I've known her for a really long time. Yes, we were friends back in Birmingham a long time ago before I ever came to Huntsville. And so I've watched her work. I knew that she was teaching at Montevallo. Yeah. Doing incredible things. She's photographed me before, and I have the photo, one of the photos, and she's just done insanely good work going over to work with the Roma people.
Yes, we were talking about that yesterday.
Just an amazing woman. She's been on a Fulbright scholarship to work with the Roma people to help them learn various arts and crafts so that they can have ways to support themselves because they're very poor people. And she's actually done hands-on work living with these people who don't have any plumbing. They don't have anything. And they're just these poor, oppressed people, the Roma people. And she has gone taking care of them and taught them stuff. She went on a Fulbright.
Right.
She was doing it actually before the Fulbright. Mm-hmm. But then she got the Fulbright to go do it.
I think she's worked on a documentary, too, about that.
She is absolutely fascinating. She also does the Japanese Buto dance. Mm-hmm. And she does the photography. And she's just this Renaissance woman. That is now, she visited Low Mill, I believe, not too long ago with some pieces, and now she's here with this photography, and I'm so, so excited about
it. It's beautiful.
Absolutely so excited. Well, I hope everyone will be as excited as I am to come out and see it, because it's going to be some wonderful work for you to see. And this is at the Low Mill this Friday, starting at 6, going to 8 p.m. It's Art After Hours, and Miss Amy Mayfield is my guest today. She is gallery coordinator of the Low Mill. Okay. So now you have three photographers, and you've seen all of this beautiful work on Cuba. Now where are we going next?
We'll go up to third floor, and in third floor west, there's actually another exhibit that Karen is part of, and it's called Blue. And there's all these different artists from around the world that have sent in pieces about the connections and the distances and the way they feel about the color blue.
Wow.
And everything's a little bit different. There's a huge fabric installation that's just incredibly painted. There's some glass prisms that hang from the ceiling. There's some photography in that piece as well. There's paintings. It's just all the ways that these people have connected with that color.
And it's blue mostly, I'm guessing.
Yes, it is.
Wow. So the blue show
is
going to be beautiful. After we linger a while in this beautiful
space. In the blue.
Yeah, where are we going next?
You'll go down to third floor east, where we have the work of Chris Beck. He is from Georgia, and he uses metal roofing materials and creates these amazingly delicate-looking pieces of art. And he does, some of them are little, you know, pieces of clothing or suits with jackets. And then my favorite piece in his exhibit is called Letters from Home. And it's an old suitcase that he's created all these little metal pieces to go in. And one of the pieces is a little serviceman's hat. And then there's little metal letters he's made. There's a little metal cigarette box, just kind of something of what the servicemen in the time of World War II would have had on them. There's little ammo pouches he's made out of metal. It's really, really, it's beautifully done.
So his show is a little bit of historical flair. Actually.
It is. It's got a little bit of everything. He's got some things that are made out of wood as well. But looking at the pieces, you would never guess that's what they were made of.
Mm-hmm. And which gallery were we in
now? That's third floor east.
Third floor east. Sounds like a great variety.
There's a huge variety.
You always have this. There's so much great art that the Low Mill brings each and every time, and it's just an absolutely great variety. Where is our next stop?
We'll go down to first floor. In first floor ramp, we actually have the work of Emily Pate. She's calling her show Remnants and Relics. She uses a lot of vintage and found objects and vintage photographs in her work. She's really interested in the idea of memory, and she expresses that in her art. She's got chicken wire and old bingo pieces and old photographs and just all sorts of things combined to make these wonderful assemblages.
I love it how artists bring things together, sometimes things that you would never think to use that are just, they make such great use of them in the pieces. Where is our next visit?
Our first floor main gallery features the work of two artists. We have Ann Herbert and Wade McDonald in there. Ann is a painter, and Wade does three-dimensional pieces. And some of his are actually lit, and they're pieces are so very different, but they actually work really well together. His a little more modern and structural, and hers are a little more lyrical And so it's really interesting to see the two of them together.
Sounds like it'll be a nice blend with different elements that will compare and contrast, mm-hmm. and that will be really cool.
I always like that when things are a little bit different, but they work together.
Yeah. This sounds fun. So now, are we done?
We have one more.
One more.
We have First Floor West, which it's a show called Radiant, and it features work from three University of Montevallo alumni and three University of Montevallo current students.
Wow.
And it's really interesting, and a lot of it, there's some videos in there. There's some different things. There's videos. There's photography. It's kind of an installation in that gallery, and I think people will really enjoy seeing what students and recent graduates have come up with.
Very cool. I think the art department at Montevallo is a well-kept secret. Maybe it's getting out a little bit that this is such a good art department, mm-hmm. but it really is. They do some amazing things.
They have come up with some amazing things.
So there will be something for everyone at the Low Mill starting at 6 o'clock this Friday as Low Mill brings you Art After Hours. My lovely guest is Miss Amy Mayfield, and she is gallery coordinator, helping to bring all of these fine things to you and working very hard on doing this. So this is going to be another absolutely glorious, big, huge bunch of exhibitions.
I hope so. I hope people come out Friday night to Low Mill Arts and Entertainment and just see a little bit of everything and enjoy what they see.
Miss Amy, can you give us a little peek into the future about some things that you might be bringing to the Low Mill?
There are so many wonderful things coming that I just think people are going to continue to be surprised and excited about the different things that are coming.
Very cool.
We have the holiday season approaching, so we'll have lots of great gift-giving options there and more events. Concerts on the Dock also kick off Friday.
That's right. We're back to the second part. Part mm-hmm. two of Concerts
part
on
two,
the Dock.
Part two, fall season.
Wow. A very busy time at the Low Mill with something for everybody.
Something for everybody and lots of fun to be had.
Of course, Concerts on the Dock. Everybody is welcome, and you can bring lawn chairs and blankets and picnics and coolers and BYOB. You can bring your pets on a leash. You can bring your children, your friends. It's all family friendly, and it's a great time to be had by all. It's on the green space back there by the East Dock, and they'll be bringing you another part of the season of wonderful musical offerings. So to get information on all of these fantastic things and to see pictures and everything, you may go to lowmill.net. Miss Amy, I want to thank you for coming to talk with
thank
me.
Thank you.
Today.
I always love to come here.
Oh, I always love talking to you. Thank you so much.
You are listening to the Public Radio Hour on 89.3 Huntsville. This week, we also took another step toward blastoff for the Space Launch System. A component built at Marshall Space Flight Center, the Launch Vehicle Stage Adapter, or LVSA, is heading off down the Mississippi River to its next stage of production. The LVSA is the largest piece of our next-generation rocket system built in Marshall's local manufacturing area. The large cone-shaped structure will connect the SLS's two largest stages. So UD Beltran got a peek at the Launch Vehicle Stage Adapter and got a lesson in stir friction welding.
I'm Reggie Spivey. I'm the director of our ESP contract, which is a contract we have with Marshall Space Flight Center that we built this hardware under.
Okay. I'm Steve Kuffner. I'm the vice president of operations, which oversees our business with the NASA programs.
Okay, so this is the Launch Vehicle Stage Adapter, which is the part we build, in conjunction with the people here at Marshall. And this joins the core stage with the interim cryogenic propulsion stage, which is the second stage. So it joins the first stage with the second stage, basically. And this is the part that we built.
And we're on radio, and so no one can really see this, but the only way I can really describe it is it looks to me like, you know, when the dog goes to the vet, and he leaves the vet, and he's wearing a cone around his neck? That's what this looks like, except it's three stories tall. It's huge.
Like 28 feet at the base, which is the size of the core stage, and 16 feet at the top, which is the size of the next stage up, and it's 30 feet tall. It's made of 16 individual panels that started out being flat panels that we buy from a supplier. Mm-hmm. The inside is machined with a structure to make it strong, and then through a special proprietary process done by one of our vendors, it is bump formed to get to the specific curvature that you see there. And so those are all shipped from California to here. We provided them to the advanced weld facility here at Marshall, and the first thing they did was do all the vertical welds on each of the two cones. Then we welded it to the ring that's on the bottom and the ring that's on the top to give it strength. And then we did the weld in the middle that puts the two cones together. And notice that it's clocked about 45 degrees so that the seams don't line up from the base all the way up to the top.
Oh, yes.
And that gives it additional strength when you do it that way. You can see where the individual welds were done. While we provided this already primed the way it is today,
right?
The welds are on the clean material. You were asking earlier about you're expecting it to be shiny. Well, it's shiny there. That's the color of the aluminum lithium alloy that we use. And they go through and they do the welding over the facility about three blocks from here. And then the young lady here runs the program where they'll be applying foam for insulation purposes for flight, but they'll prime all of those shiny joints before they go ahead and apply the insulation.
Now, I watched some YouTube videos on this type of welding, which is it's basically a circle that spins super, super fast.
It's friction stir welding, and unlike what you normally think of welding is a torch or something that
right.
heats material and they add some other material that joins two pieces together. In this particular case, there's none of that. It's merely the friction from a for lack of a bit, if you will, that spins very quickly that stirs the material together from the two panels.
Oh, and so it isn't melting.
It is not melting.
Oh, okay.
It is stirring that together. And the expert's John Street. He's the one that runs the facility that does all that. But they did it eight times on the top cone, eight times on the bottom cone, and then they did it once on the bottom ring, once on the top ring, and once in the middle. All of that took many, many months to accomplish, and you can imagine holding the precision to be able to do that to make sure that it is perpendicular and straight and parallel for all these different planes, because you only have one shot at it, otherwise you ruin the panels.
Right, right. So then you built the panels at your facility?
Well, actually we bought the materials and shipped them to a vendor out in California to do the machining and the forming to put the curvature in it.
Okay. So then, as someone said earlier today, this is an American rocket.
It is. And the coating is done somewhere else, and the machining was done somewhere else. The panels that go on the inside are done somewhere else. We buy the material from another place. So this is truly a partnership between industry and then using the government to help do the welding, using the government to help do the application of the foam insulation, using their facilities, because we don't have a building that's big enough to have this thing in it on the stand. I mean, we even built the stand here, okay?
Oh, gotcha.
So that stand was built specifically for this device, and that stand will be used to transport this from here on a barge all the way down the Mississippi River, Gulf of Mexico, around the Cape of Florida, and up to Kennedy Space Center, and that stand holds it to the barge while they do that.
You're kidding. That's how it's leaving here?
Going to get here?
It's going down the Mississippi River?
Yep. The same thing with the motors that are made out at Michoud. Same barge vehicle, except it'll be on the side rather than standing up like this, but it goes down in the same vehicle called Pegasus.
Okay.
And it's barged down the Mississippi to the Gulf, around the Cape of Florida, and up to Kennedy Space Center, where it is then going to be integrated in one of their facilities and taken out to the launch pad.
We're hoping for a safe journey for the LVSA and a good evening to you. Thanks for listening. You can also find tonight's segments and find links related to tonight's show at WLRH.org. Look for the Public Radio Hour. And thanks to everyone who's sharing thoughts and ideas. Keep those coming. The Public Radio Hour is built weekly by WLRH staff and volunteers. Have a great night. City Arts and Lectures is next.
On the next APM Reports documentary, undocumented children have a right to go to U.S. public schools, but there's no right to go to college.
Why am I not here? Why can't I be here?
They shouldn't be in the country to begin with, much less in our colleges, competing with our American students.
Listen for Shadow Class, College Dreamers in Trump's America from APM.
On the next Public Radio Hour, Thursday night at 7 on 89.3 Huntsville.